The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Tough. George Best, Roy Keane, European Cups, league titles, international tournaments, the Republic of Ireland job. Martin O'Neill's football CV has very few gaps. A new memoir on days like these tells the tale of an extraordinary career. Martin, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
I want to talk to you about how the game has changed. It's so long since you first pulled on a pair of boots.
Thank you for reminding me.
So how has the game changed in terms of the football itself, the professionalism, the referees, the equipment, the pitches?
Mm. Well, every one of those that you've just mentioned, absolutely. And most of those have changed for the better. I came into the game, I'll talk about the English professional game, as a 19-year-old way back in late 1971. Where the man of the moment, if not the year, was the likes of George Best, for instance. And I think all you have to do is have a little look at the pitches in which he was playing in, and those were the pitches that we were subjected to. Nice enough for about six weeks of the year, then ploughing through winter time. So if you look now at the changes that are taking place, and the number of young fellows that I see who have looked at YouTube at some of the games that we've been playing in, just cannot believe it. Really cannot believe it.
So and the ball, heavy in the west.
The ball was heavy, absolutely. And so a lighter ball, naturally. Better pitches. Change also of a rule of the one where the back pass rule, you know, that existed in my time. So the goalkeeper could grab the ball and then take all the time in the world if his particular team were leading. That has changed. That's good. You're talking about the extra professionalism, absolutely. You know, now, and I will talk about the part of the game that you think that you would never be involved in, like the upper, shall I say, the upper crust of it, the managing upwards type of thing.
Yeah.
So, for instance, a manager would have he would have a secretary, perhaps he might have an assistant, and he might have a coach. And that really would be it. Then he would go straight to the board. Now we have a CEO who's got big say, you know. And I think because the money is so big now, I think that you're almost inventing jobs for it, you know. And I'm not so sure that that's a great thing. However, most of the changes are excellent. Yet then when you come back again, you look at the sort of play acting that's taking place now, and really can disturb you. No, really can.
So the dive was not so much a feature when you started to play.
Not at all. And I can say that with all sincerity. You did. You know, they reckoned that a player called Francis Lee used to get some penalties by actually diving in the penalty area. Francis Lee was a great player, played for Manchester City in England. And during our time here, we thought that there might be something in it. He might be buying a couple of penalty kicks. But overall, if you're talking about one player in the game, you know, it was, but it's.
And would players have kind of taken someone to task if they suspected he was effectively cheating?
Okay, I'm not so sure about that. If you were a very good diver in your team, Johanna, that I think you'd be inclined to
be cherished.
You'd be inclined to pat him in the back and say, "Well done." But there wasn't too much of that. I thought the thing that you were going to ask me what would be players. There was a lot of lousy tackling going in the game, and players just picked themselves up. Really did pick themselves up. I can see it now so clearly. George Best going through, I think it was at Old Trafford against Chelsea, Ron Harris coming from nowhere to take his legs off and Best still keeping balance to score a goal. Yeah. And
when you consider the heavy ball in the wet, the condition of the pitch, to watch George Best on YouTube is still a revelation.
Absolutely, man, absolutely. He would have added at least another 150 goals to his tally if he was playing today.
Yeah. Now, your own background, a Catholic nationalist Derry family.
Yep.
GAA would have been in the blood.
Absolutely. My father helped found the local Gaelic team, Kilray Pierce's, and we had a large family, stretched out a little bit. So my two older brothers, not only to play for Kilray, but play for Derry. And Leo, as an 18-year-old, was a sub in the All-Ireland final way back in 1958.
And you tell a story about that because it wasn't shared with you that he was only going to be a sub. You thought he was going to start. You all go to Croke Park and it's a big, big day.
Absolutely. Well, he had played in the semi-final against Kerry and apparently he played really well.
Yeah.
But
And had he played maybe, you would have beaten Dublin instead.
Oh, no. Dublin were really strong. Yeah. They were really strong. Even as a six-year-old, I knew that Dublin might be strong, you know, so not at all. I'm not saying that, but it was an experience to go there with my mother.
Now, in terms of your introduction to the beautiful game, as distinct from the Gaelic game, I'm sure it was all around you because soccer was a game of the streets for pretty much everybody. It certainly was in my growing up. But your other brother, we mentioned Leo, Jerry comes back with a tennis ball to you one day. And he hands you the tennis ball. And what does he tell you?
He tells me that he has been reading Puskas's autobiography. Now, Puskas, for the younger audience, was a fantastic footballer. Played for Real Madrid, Hungarian player. And escaped the 1956 Rising, I think, you know, and got out of Hungary. And became a brilliant, brilliant player for Real Madrid. So he scored four goals in a European Cup final. Di Stefano, his friend, scored the other three. Real Madrid beat Eintracht Frankfurt, and I was absolutely smitten. However, my brother, back from university, tells me that Puskas can keep a tennis ball up 200 times in his foot without dropping it.
You know, keepy uppy or is keepy for uppy, two.
Keepy uppy. And I was determined that I could do this. So obviously he threw the tennis ball to me. It fell off my feet at 2, 3, 4. And I was determined to do it. So he comes back about 3 months later, I think, for a midterm break. And I said, come on, let's see this. And I could keep it up 200 times. And of course, I thought, well, if I can keep it up 200 times, I'm going to be as good as Puskas. I'm afraid maybe that's where it ended.
But you were an exceptional player, as it turned out. Now, you went to two different schools at the junior level. You went to St. Columb's, and then you went on to St. Malachy's for your A-levels, playing Gaelic football all the way through both of your childhood schools. But then in Belfast and St. Malachy's, also playing soccer.
Yes. Family moved up to Belfast in 1968, and my mother and father had lived early part of their married life in Belfast, and I think she really enjoyed Belfast, really did enjoy it. But I think also it was an opportunity for us, myself and my younger brothers, to become day boys at a college, and therefore be able to get
home. Boarding.
I'd been boarding for 5 years before that, and I suppose maybe up in the big city as well too, there might be more opportunities for the things that you just mentioned, Pat. Maybe playing football as well too, like soccer football, and so all those things actually did come to pass, almost vicariously, but they did too. Now, of course, at that time, two things happening. Number one, we moved up in summer of 1968. The civil rights marches started in about the January of 1969. So we were, the troubles were soon upon us. Second thing about the rules at that time were that, of course, if you played soccer, you weren't allowed to play Gaelic. You could be banned.
Absolutely, because it happened in my school. Kids played in the Easter League and...
I know we think not now as we sit down here today and think that it's kind of crazy, but it was at the time. And so I was playing for St. Malachy's College. And by this time, not only had I gone from a Rosario youth team, which didn't seem to matter to anyone, I'm talking about soccer, but then I ended up playing for Distillery. Now, of course, that's a different issue. I'm now playing Irish League football for Distillery.
And you're visible.
Absolutely. And as a consequence, our college's game against a fellow Belfast college had to be moved, couldn't play at Casement Park, which we would love to have done, was moved to Omagh, about 40 miles away, because the
Martin O'Neill was banned.
I wasn't allowed to play at Casement Park, which is, you know, still a massive disappointment to me.
Now, moving on to your time in Notts Forest, and you arrived there before Brian Clough did.
Yeah.
So what was it like when he burst through the dressing room door for the first time?
Well, absolutely. Well, he had had, this would be January, early January 1975, and it's like yesterday to me, really is. Our manager, the manager that we had, Alan Brown, has just got sacked, and we think that we're going to get Brian Clough. Now, Brian Clough had been manager of Derby County, 15, 16, 17 miles away, and Derby County had been champions in 1972, as they call it in this day, Premier League champions. I know he had a tough 44 days at Leeds, but we, second division Nottingham Forest, might be getting Brian Clough for a start. this is a man who was on Parkinson's show every third week, and Michael Parkinson. And so he comes through that door and he just throws his coat on the side, onto a peg to his left-hand side. And honestly, I mean, it really changed our lives forever. If you had said then from 1975, by the time that 1980 arrives, you know, we will get promotion, win the league, win a couple of league cups, win two European cups on top of that there. I think with the motley crew that we had in that dressing room, I think...
So he had magic.
He did, absolutely. He was... I'm going to say, right, first of all, he's the most charismatic manager that I could ever work with. But actually, he's possibly the most charismatic man I've ever been involved with.
Now, in the meantime, there's...
With the odd exception.
We can talk about that in a little while. You get to play for Northern Ireland. You're in the squad. Mm-hmm. And you tell a story about having to play a match in Hull against Spain because Windsor Park is not available to the Northern Ireland team because of the troubles. Mm-hmm. And George arrives, George Best. In what condition?
Not great. Not great. Remember, we are talking about a man. This is February of 1972. George Best is definitely the most talked about player in Europe at this stage. He looks fantastic. He's great. You know, honestly, you would love to be like him. You know, sorry, I would love to have been like him. And George, of course, you never knew whether George would actually turn up for the games. You know, and we had to meet up. We, the Northern Ireland squad, had to meet up in Hull on the Monday morning and then go to a hotel in Scarborough. No sign of George at all. By 10 o'clock that evening, George arrives with his friend, who I think was running George's boutique in Manchester at the time. Two of them out of it.
Four sheets.
Absolutely, four sheets, no question about it. But it didn't matter. It didn't matter to us. George has arrived. And of course, he used to share a room with Pat Jennings, you know, as you would, the two of them being our superstars in our team. And then there's this mad charge up to the room to listen to all George's stories. And a couple of months earlier, Pat, I'm in a Queen's University lecture hall, you know, trying to deal with jurisprudence. And here I am in George Best's bedroom listening to stories. Now, he wouldn't have had a clue, even though I'd scored a goal against Manchester United a couple of weeks earlier, sorry, just before Christmas. George wouldn't have taken any notice of that, not at all. But I'm right at the back of the room as he's in, hopped into bed, starting to tell us these stories. And of course, it was just incredible.
And I mean, when the women chasing him, he takes it on board. Like, whereas you would have been maybe delighted, flattered. He just took it. You know, this is what I'm used to.
I would still have been flattered and delighted even now. But he took absolutely. There was a corridor. Kind of a corridor formed a little bit for him by these two stout gentlemen in the foyer of the hotel, because by that time everyone in Scarborough, where we were staying, had got to know that George was there. And honestly, it was chaotic.
Now, all the way through the book, there are all sorts of little lessons that you learn. Like, I think you have to be somewhat arrogant to be a professional footballer. I think you have to be. I don't think you can play unless you believe that you've got what it takes to get out there and score goals. But you talk to the press, you talk out of turn in Hull because you weren't picked to start the game.
Well, I have to say this, Pump. When I was writing this story, I had to, I mean, I still cover myself in embarrassment. It's really, it's awful. First of all, I have a manager who has been a big instigator and actually helping me get to Nottingham Forest in the first place. There's no point in going into that story. He's called Terry Neal. Terry Neal is the player manager of Hull. He's also the player manager of Northern Ireland. So that's why we're up at Hull in this particular game, because of the troubles. So what happens is that I'm in the squad and I think I've got a bit of a chance of playing. And I probably wouldn't have felt too bad about it, but then they introduce a player who wasn't in the squad initially, Sammy Morgan. And Sammy's putting in front of me. And of course, I started to tell the press guys, I might as well go home. Yeah. I haven't been 10 minutes in the game. and it's on. I'm actually embarrassed. I'm embarrassed now.
Because the guy comes up to you and he kind of, he's, oh, you poor you. You
absolutely,
know.
Absolutely.
Not like a reporter, more like a friend.
Absolutely. And I fell for it, but big time, honestly. Only for the, that was the first time I fell for it. And I've only fallen for it about 6,000 times since. But yeah, absolutely. Yeah. He was telling me, oh, I think you should be my. And of course, I'm pouring out this sort of grief to him. And he's writing it down. So Terry Neal, the next morning, gets to hear about it. He summons me up like a school teacher up to the room, honestly berates me, absolutely right, totally right, and said, honestly, son, if I think about it really now, I should send you home. Anyway, so he doesn't. I go there. I see George Best taking out his boots, his match boots from the previous Saturday, which had not been cleaned, and he smashes the boots, he knocks them down to take the muck off.
Yeah.
George Best, and asking for some shoe polish to polish his shoes. George Best, the best player in Europe, asking for these things. I think to myself today, I wonder what any of the lads in the Premier League be saying. Oh, excuse me, lads, where's the polish? But anyway, but even so, to cap a terrible, terrible day, I get on in the second half. Terry Neal he decides, well, we'll put him in. And I'm hopeless. So any thought that I had, it was one of those where I'm going to show him. I'm going to show him I should have been starting in the game. Never got a kick.
And the worst thing, Sammy Morgan scored.
Sammy scored. Do you know what? I think I've apologised to Sammy about 15 times since that there. But absolutely, Sammy Morgan scored the goal and we drew 1-1.
I'm talking with Martin O'Neill about his autobiography On Days Like These.
The Pat Kenny Show.
With Aviva Insurance.
On News Talk.
I'm talking with Martin O'Neill about his book, which is absolutely terrific, On Days Like These. Your book is divided into sections. Of course, you became a football manager. What prompted the move into management? I mean, you could have backed out of football entirely, maybe, and got a career in business or whatever.
Well, actually, you're right. I had really no intention whatsoever, even in the latter stages of my playing career, of going into management. Never really thought about it at all. And by a chance meeting, Peter Taylor, who was Brian Clough's assistant manager, Taylor was very good. I'm not saying that he particularly liked me in things like this here. And the more I read the book, I'm not surprised he doesn't like me. But what I'm saying is that he had retired from the game. He had fallen out with Brian Clough, you know, because he retired from Nottingham Forest. Brian Clough looked after him, and then the following year, he's at Derby County. So this would be anathema to Brian Clough. Anyway, so fast forward now to about 1986. Taylor's retired from the game. I see him in a shop. He's coming out of a shop at the same time as I'm going into the shop. And his first words were, he said, "You disappoint me. You disappoint me." And I said, "What?" He said, "I thought you would go into management." He said, "Because, you know, you had the two best teachers in the world," he said, "with myself and Brian," things like this here. And actually, although he was saying I disappointed him, to a certain extent a compliment in that sense.
A huge compliment, yeah.
Because I wish he had said, "You were a really good player, you know," but I didn't know. But and I seemed to have these battles with him. Anyway, do you know what I did? I went back home. I genuinely thought about it, and then I think I remember Billy Bingham saying that Billy Bingham being the Northern Ireland manager, in a quiet moment saying to me, "I think you should look at it." And then a combination of all of that, thought, "Okay, I'll do it," and I applied for loads and loads of jobs and didn't get any of them at all. In fact, some of the letters arrived and some didn't, you know, for the turning of the jobs down or just disapproval, as it were.
But you did get into management with Wickham, and you went all the way. I mean, Celtic was probably the pinnacle of your managerial achievements because you won so much with Celtic. But we move on to the Ireland job.
Yep.
Again, were you the reluctant aspirant to that job?
No, I wasn't. No, I was probably moping and moaning of what happened after Sunderland and Dermot Desmond, Dermot, who had taken me to Celtic. Dermot phoned and said, well, just stop your moping around. He said, you know, there's a job here. A Trapattoni was just leaving the proceedings. And I'm not just saying this, but to me, I thought, absolutely, this is fantastic. This is a privilege to manage the team, to manage an international side. Now, the reservations I had were this, not for the job itself, but to know that an international football, totally different.
Yeah.
Totally different to club football. It means you have to get your head round, you know, playing a game, winning or losing in, let's say, November time, and then finding out that then your next match is March. That was
with the lads. Maybe 3 days before.
Maybe
a couple of games. Maybe.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. So those things, and then the length of time you had to wait for games, and then what you were doing in between times was going to a lot of matches to watch the players. And some of the games you were coming away from, you didn't even know the score of the game because you're just concentrating on those players. But I knew these things. You know, I'd watched international managers and I talked to international managers. You know, Roy Hodgson, for instance, you know, had been telling me it can be difficult, particularly if you don't get the result in November. Christmas is really, really bad. But I knew these things. And I genuinely, because of the history of the Republic, because of Jack Charlton, and I'm seeing those days where Jack Charlton, despite the sort of criticism for him being put in charge, he's telling these players what to do. Great, great players, you know, telling them what to do. And the scenes when they were coming back, you know, at the airport, into Dublin City, they were fantastic, absolutely fantastic. And the Irish crowd, they loved the old celebration. And I was desperately hoping if we could qualify for France, that we could recapture, not relive, but recapture.
No, because the first time is always different.
Absolutely,
always different.
Absolutely, never. That will never be bettered. Yeah. Never be bettered because it's the first time.
You then decided that you'd like Roy Keane as your assistant manager. Now, what did John Delaney make of that decision? Because there would have been, shall we say, a fraught relationship.
Yes,
there?
Of course, absolutely. But when I said to him after I picked John off the table. I think he feigned it three times after it said it. But in fairness to John, he did say, I have no problem. He said, I have no problem with that. There we go. On. He did say something about, we'll have to batten down the hatches, you know. But he
life
did.
Is going to get interesting.
It's going to get interesting, absolutely. Do I think that if I had made another choice as an assistant manager, he might have been happier? Perhaps, you know. Hmm. But even so. So Roy, okay, Roy comes in.
You have great time for Roy's astuteness as an understander of the game.
If this feels as if this is almost sycophancy, you know, would it? He genuinely does, but you know, I make this ridiculous point about saying that if you get a reputation for being an early riser, it means you can lie in bed all day. Yeah. His reputation is one of get up and get at them. You know, this motivational thing. You know, inspiring players around him as a player. You know, for 10 years driving great players on. But I honestly think, and one of the great managers of all time, and Sir Alex Ferguson, but Sir Alex Ferguson's lieutenant out there was Roy Keane.
Yeah.
It wasn't David Beckham, it wasn't Paul Scholes, it wasn't Gary Neville, it wasn't Schmeichel, it was Roy Keane. Roy Keane, and we know this, you know. Now, obviously, Roy became a divisive character in many aspects over the Saipan incident in 2002. But even so, he said, I know that had been forgotten. He wanted to do it. I didn't for 1 minute say that I knew Roy, you know, intimately or anything like that. Far from it. And if this had been a club job, I think that we might have another thoughts about it. You know, having Roy with you every single day, the intensity. Not sure even I could have dealt with that. You know, but the many aspects we thought, yeah, let's go with it. And of course, that one of the big things as well. He was only a few years apart from some of the players as well too. So, and these players, like the Robbie Bradys and the Jeff Hendricks in this year, would have grown up as Roy being a hero. Yeah. So I thought that all of these things could work in our favour.
Now, you did make it to France. Mm. Now, they took a couple of very notable scalps along the way. And ultimately, the adventure ended in, I think it was Lyon, when France beat the side.
France had by the way, Pat, and I know it sounds, excuses, but France had a week to prepare and we had 2 days.
2 days.
But listen, would they have beaten us? They could have done, had we. But we took the lead in the game. And James McLean has a chance to level the game with about 6 minutes to go. A really good chance to the game. Anyway,
sliding
that's it. Doors.
But, you know, when you're organising the tournament in your own country, certain things happen. You know, that's the way it goes. You decided to persist. You know, you could have left at that moment. You'd done what you were asked to do, but you stayed on. And then we ultimately come to the end of your career with a 5-0 defeat by Denmark.
5-1,
rather. And, you know, you were excoriated that night and you feel quite badly about the way you were treated after that defeat.
Well, OK, Pat. First of all, let's go back. My contract really with the Republic of Ireland depended on us qualifying for France. It doesn't mean that I might not have got another contract at that time. It doesn't mean that, but I would be definitely getting a contract with the Republic of Ireland for the World Cup if we made it to France. So, and everything was kind of rosy in that sense. Yes, I had an opportunity to go back into club football. But you know what? I just wanted to try and qualify for the World Cup. Again, Jack Charlton's days, all this type of stuff. Yeah. And I will go back to the opening game in France when we played Sweden to see 20-odd thousand Irish fans there that game singing like they were singing. That to me, that was actually heaven. It was really, really great. Okay, so you want to try and recapture that. So we're in the group, and it's tough work the whole way through. We're in Serbia, we're in with different sides. But we finally, and we were four seeds, so we finally get into the playoffs, beating Wales down in Wales, and we're in the playoffs against Denmark. And we've drawn in Copenhagen, so the expectation is high. And we get into the lead in the game, we have a chance to make it 2-0. Who knows what might happen?
Yeah.
Long and the short of it, we're well beaten. I deserve the criticism, we're well beaten in the game. I make some substitutions at halftime that I knew would weaken us physically, but we had to try and get a goal. This is it. We had to win the game.
Yeah.
And then Eriksson just tears us apart. Sometimes that happens. We're beaten. But it felt to me, that's all, you know. And please, I'm absolutely not feeling sorry for myself, and I might have a different view now than when I held then at that time. But it was a playoff for the World Cup to try and qualify for the World Cup. It wasn't a game where we'd just been hammered in the opening game of the series or something again. It wasn't a playoff game. Well beaten, definitely. But I honestly felt as if it was an outpouring of vitriol really attached to me. That was my view then. It probably really hasn't changed a great deal.
And you got sympathy that night from an unexpected quarter when you were leaving, the treatment that the press had handed out to you. Was it from the one of the press people from the other side?
Go on.
You know, one of the Danish people.
Oh, sorry. Oh, that was later. Yeah. Okay, so let me tell you what, yes. No, so the criticism then, I thought it was tough. I didn't handle it well, man. Absolutely, did not handle the whole situation well. And the minute that you come out of a dressing room, you've just been beaten in the game. You know, the team are lying in a heap, really. You know, almost literally in the dressing room. You've come out there. Your chance of playing in the World Cup is gone, and you're so close. And I'm coming out, and then you know to be said that is this a sackable offence at the time? And I know. Didn't deal with it well. Okay, so fast forward then, we go into a competition called the Nations League. And I'm doing a little bit of experimentation. It wasn't really that important because no one actually knew the rules at that time. They'd kind of made them up. And there was a possible gateway into the Euros if that was possible next time round. But overall, they were glorified friendlies. We played badly in the matches. We played badly. We drew twice with Denmark, and we honestly just did not play well, and that's down to me, absolutely and utterly down to me. Didn't play well in the games, and Wales beat us in the matches. So it was, but at that time there was a couple of other incidents happening around about Declan Rice. This idea that because Declan Rice's father, I went to visit a couple of times. Really nice man, genuinely really nice man, wanted Declan to play for the Republic of Ireland.
Yeah, because he was born in Ireland, whereas Declan was born in Britain.
And honestly, Pat, and I'll just take 30 seconds to explain this. So I had given Declan 3 caps, but they were all friendly games. I could see that he could definitely play the game. You know, you knew that he could play. Could he improve our team? Absolutely, absolutely. But Declan had an agent. Declan's agent, I think, contacted Gareth Southgate. And Declan, whatever you say, you cannot force somebody to do something they don't want to do. At this minute, as Declan Rice is going off to the World Cup, do you think that he will have a regret of any of that there? I wouldn't have thought so. But it seems as if I'm still to be blamed now for not being able to persuade Declan Rice, who might have a mind of his own, to play for the Republic of Ireland.
You mentioned also that sometimes you were made to feel a little bit like an outsider because you came from Northern Ireland and not from the Republic.
Okay. I'll tell you what, I think that somebody's mentioned there just recently that I always wanted to feel as if I was the smartest one in the room. I will say this, Matt, that couldn't be further from the truth. Absolutely. Number one, I couldn't be, because there's generally, if there were four in the room, there'd be three smarter than me for a start in any room. Secondly, it wasn't the intention. Sometimes the press guys in Dublin would say to me, for instance, we'd love to hear maybe a Brian Clough story. And after the press conference was over, I would regale I'm not even that good. But what I'm saying is that I would tell them maybe a Brian Clough story, generally against myself or something like this here, and it would, you know, cause a bit of amusement. Then a fortnight later, we'd say, O'Neill only ever wanted to talk about Brian Clough. He bored us with Brian Clough stories. And sometimes those wee things are hard to take, really. Listen, everyone has an opinion. It took me not that long to realise how dislikable I was. And it was, you know, I didn't get the press in Ireland here, and I don't think they ever got me either. It didn't really.
But do you think that was to do with the Northern Ireland thing that
I was called a Northerner on a number of occasions, and I remember saying this to Roy, and early on, Roy, and I don't mean early on. I really do not mean early on. I mean really from the disaster against Denmark from then on, and or actually probably a little bit before that. Do you know what I felt sometimes, Ben? I felt as if the winning of the football matches, which is what this game is about, wasn't enough. It wasn't enough for these lads, you know. And I absolutely, and please, this is not to sound sycophantic towards the crowd, I'd absolutely not. The night we beat Bosnia, maybe more so than the night we beat Germany, because Bosnia, there was a finality to it, and now we're in France. Is up there with any moment in my career, really any moment in my career. And actually, when Robbie Brady scores the goal against Italy, I almost headed it in for him myself. So those were fantastic moments. And to see the crowd, we played badly in my last year, absolutely right. So you deserve any criticism that's coming. But I didn't honestly ever think it was from the fans.
Keith Andrews is a pundit for some of this time, and he had a right go. And I don't know, you have a little, I suppose, a sliding tackle at him at the end of the book, where you say, look, it's not as easy as it looks from the pundit's couch. Now, you're Stephen Kenny's assistant. Show us what you can do.
Well, I have to say, and I'm not going to regret this, absolutely right. Here's the point, amazing thing. The press, you take criticism from the press. I've taken criticism all my life. And sometimes I think it's over the top. Many a time I think it's absolutely deserved, no problem. Sometimes then when a player comes in, you know, when a player who should know a little bit better is criticising, then that's tough. And then when it's a player who hasn't done anything in the game, I think that's even harder to do. And Keith would be in that category, not having had a great deal to have done in the game. Now, you might think that's rather acerbic, but it's right. Now, so his criticism was, you know, that we're relying on set pieces. Well, set pieces is still part of the game. And funnily enough, you know, the Republic just at this minute, and quite a number of the goals have been scored from set pieces. Absolutely fine. Absolutely fine. And when somebody says that they wouldn't do it in your manner or whatever the case may be, I'm sure that that time when he was criticising, he probably didn't. He probably didn't think that he was going to get into that very position. You know, it's a wee bit reminds me of Gary Neville once. Gary Neville said he watched a game on TV that Valencia had been beaten by Real Madrid 7-1 or something is here in the Nou Camp. against Barcelona, I think. And he said, imagine, and he started to criticise the manager of Valencia. And I think he said, if I was ever in that position, he said, I'd never put my head above water again. And the chances of that happening at the time were about 35 million to one. Remarkably, it happened. He became manager of Valencia and went there and got beaten by seven. So what I'm saying to you is sometimes you don't think you're in that position. It seems to have caused an awful lot of headlines, really. It is one paragraph in the book. Yeah. But at the end of it all, it's
an absolutely terrific read. Not in the book, of course, is Qatar. Do you have any thoughts on what's going to happen in Qatar?
Are you talking politically? Or are you talking about?
I'm just talking about the whole idea of having a tournament in a tiny little country with no footballing tradition, but lots of money.
Absolutely. I can't get my head around it. I couldn't do it when the draw was made, we were all told that Qatar was going to be the place. I thought to myself, I remember in my dreams, way back when as a kid, thinking, I wonder would Northern Ireland ever have the World Cup? And I thought to myself, you know, how would you fit in all these people going to Cliftonville Stadium and going to Windsor Park? And I really did think these things in my head. I was about seven at the time. I thought, it couldn't possibly work because people would be running into each other. Now, remarkably, it looks as if for the number of miles, what is it, 40 miles or something this year, I think?
Qatar will fit inside Cork and Kerry combined.
It's unbelievable. And also, Matt, as well, too, when it was pioneered or told that it was going to be Qatar, they were talking about summertime as well too. So listen, they've made the arrangements now at this minute. I've no doubt. When I start to watch it, I'll start and maybe even enjoy it. I don't know at the end of the day, but I just at this minute can't get my head around it.
Well, the book, as I say, is a terrific read. It's simply called Martin O'Neill, On Days Like These, My Life in Football, published by Macmillan. And Martin O'Neill, thank you very much for joining us on the
program.
No,
thank you, Pat. Really appreciate it.
The Pat Kenny Show.
With Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.